are listening to Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast, episode 16 for Tuesday, March 29th, 2022. JJ Sefton here, along with CBD, and returning once again is our co-blogger and colleague, Joe Mannix. Gentlemen, good afternoon.
Hello. Actually, I was going to say your real name, so hello, JJ. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Joe, you there?
I am. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. So this morning I started off, and instead of talking about Ukraine and the usual nonsense going on over there, we still have this ridiculous inquisition known as the January 6th Investigative Committee in Congress. And their latest target for today is the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, Ginny Thomas. And they want to get at her because she had the temerity to, she committed the high crime and misdemeanor of actually speaking to Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, on the day of the January 6th so-called quote-unquote riot. And now they're using this as a pretext to want to not only excoriate and rip her, but to get to Clarence Thomas and to see if they can get him to either recuse himself from any upcoming trials or, even better, hey, get him to resign because he committed some sort of treasonous act.
Or give them a fig leaf for some impeachment process, although I think not even I don't even think the Congress as it is now would have the guts to try that, but maybe that might be an angle. But when I read about this story and them going after Ginny Thomas, I had a thought, which is we've seen stuff like this before, usually loudly opposed by the left. And a great example I can think of is Robert Oppenheimer. So after World War II, Oppenheimer being one of our premier atomic scientists and responsible for many elements of the atomic weapons that we developed during the war, he was sort of frozen out of that and pushed out of that in a large number of dimensions because his wife was active in various communist groups. So it was, this woman is at least communist curious, if not actually a communist, and therefore Robert Oppenheimer is a liability. And that's the way that went. And this was a huge target from those on the left at the time of, this is way out of bounds. You can't do this. You're not talking about Oppenheimer himself. You're talking about his wife and some theoretical influence that she might have on him and that might make him a liability. And what you're doing is completely wrong. The man's a national hero, and you're doing this to him because his wife isn't aligned with your political preferences. And now they're doing the exact same thing to Clarence Thomas with his wife. And it's just an interesting inversion. It hasn't been that long that this exact thing that they're now trying to do was a national shame. And now they're doing it, and it's national heroism.
Well, you can fast forward 50 years to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's cheerleading for Planned Parenthood, should have been, you know, an immediate recusal from many, many cases. Certainly, her review of some of the federal cases that didn't even reach the Supreme Court, she should have recused herself. But apparently, the left is perfectly comfortable with a cheerleader for an incredibly divisive and probably unconstitutional thing that is abortion, or a national law regulating abortion. But as Joe points out, this is the chaotic thought process of the left. They are politically expedient and nothing else.
I'm sorry, you could take it a little bit further, or it's a bit of a different tack, is that at least, look, you could say that Robert Oppenheimer presented, or the secrets that he had, and because his wife was an actual confirmed communist, or communist curious, as Joe said, as a national security risk, I mean, a legitimate national security risk. And also, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was going to rule on a case where she should recuse, and she was also the chief counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. But in this case, we have an individual who, I mean, what they're trying to do is paint what happened on January 6th, or even the election, as even questioning it as some sort of a thought crime or a crime, or that the insurrection was on our side of the aisle, not theirs. So it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit as nefarious, if not more nefarious. And I can even go back 4 years prior. It's Mike Flynn. Mike Flynn didn't do anything. He was railroaded out of his position. And I think this is what they're trying to do, to set up Justice Thomas, not just to recuse himself, but to actually get him thrown out of the court.
But this is political expediency. It's a perfect example. You know, you go back to the saying, you know, one man, one vote, one time. You know, this is exactly what's going on. The left is, you know, an ardent supporter of free speech when it helps them. But the second that it is no longer necessary, they shut it down. And they shut it down hard.
And it's because there is only one actual core tenet when you're in the in this left group, right? And it's not free speech if I agree with it, right? That's not free speech. It's anything that maximizes my power. And that is the only standard, whether it's directly expedient or if it requires playing the long game or even making tactical retreats, which they do on occasion, or they had done. They're not doing it anymore. But it's the only thing that matters is, does it increase my power? If yes, it's good. If no, it's not only wrong, it's actually evil and has to be destroyed.
This is a good segue into what happened recently at Yale Law School. The enlightened elite at Yale decided that some speech is beyond the pale and shouted down a series of speakers, I think the Federalist Society speakers. And they were very, very comfortable with the idea of censorship of unpleasant ideas. And of course, we on the right, we conservatives see it as axiomatic that comfortable speech is nothing. It doesn't matter what you say. If it makes me comfortable, I don't care. It's what makes me uncomfortable that I should defend. And these are the budding Supreme Court justices at Yale who find that reprehensible. They think that any speech that makes them uncomfortable, that they dislike, that is antithetical to their political beliefs and their political goals, should be shut down. To his credit, I think Joe knows a little bit more about this. A federal judge didn't like that idea.
Just to clarify before Joe takes the floor on this, because I think he's more knowledgeable than I am, it wasn't the officials or the faculty or the deans of Yale Law School that shut things down. It was students who were basically like Maoists who rushed into the room and carrying signs and screaming and actually threatening the speakers physically, if certainly verbally abusing them and preventing them from speaking. So, and then at the end of the day, I believe they got a slap on the wrist, but Joe can enlighten us more on this.
Yeah, it was a student-led thing, and it seems to somewhat reflect oddly enough the free speech activism in places like Berkeley in a prior era, right, which was all student-led, and the administration was either quietly aligned or simply afraid, right, and took no action to uphold whatever university standard it might be. But yeah, there was, in response to this, there was a federal judge, and I neglected to write down the gentleman's name, who basically came out with the assessment of, this is really the wrong thing to do, and I call on other judges, in when you're selecting your clerks, don't select anybody who participated in this from as a clerk. And fair enough, and I can understand where he's coming from. I think it's the wrong approach, because one of the big problems, and it comes up all the time in conversation, at least political conversation, is that all of our ruling class, whether they're in government or industry, or the judiciary, which is also government, there are certain institutions that are seriously represented, right? The Ivy Leagues, the Stanford, these places, the government and major corporate institutions are just riddled with them. And saying, if you participated in this, you shouldn't be hired as a clerk, is obvious in my mind. What's less obvious and perhaps more important is, if you went to these institutions, you should probably be excluded from consideration. I won't hire a Yale lawyer as my clerk, because what these students did, yes, and it was student-led, is reprehensible. What their institution did is even worse by declining to punish them. And whether it's because they're afraid or because they're in on it is somewhat beside the point. The institution is rotten, and these rotten institutions should be purged from our government, and that can be done on a case-by-case basis. Me, Mr. Joe, federal judge, I'm not hiring anyone from Yale. We're going to cast a wider net. We're going to see who else we get. That's what I'd like to see. Not just punish the people who did it, but punish the institution and make the name. When I see Yale on a resume, it's no longer a benefit. If anything, you're going to have to work harder to prove you're not one of them. And until we get there, I don't think much of this improves.
Yeah, it was Judge Lawrence Silberman of the D.C. Circuit, U.S. Court of Appeals, that said it. To all Article III judges, the latest events at Yale Law School, in which students attempted to shout down speakers participating in a panel discussion on free speech, prompts me to suggest that students who are identified as those willing to disrupt any such panel discussion should be noted. All federal judges, and all federal judges are presumably committed to free speech, should carefully consider whether any student so identified should be disqualified for potential clerkships.
I think Joe's point is well taken. The fecklessness of academia has been documented over the last two generations. But I think it has become worse in the last, probably dozen years. And I don't think that can be repaired. Unfortunately, if you look at Justice Barrett, who came out of Notre Dame, I believe, she is not the perfect justice. I think that all law schools should be suspect. And while this would never happen, the idea of a non-lawyer on the Supreme Court, I think, is a wonderful idea. It would bring a sense of balance to a court that is so immersed in the muck of theoretical law that they simply don't look out their windows. Now, that's true of the Yale Ivory Tower. Those deans do very, very little except coddle their elite students. And once again, Joe, you're 100% correct. Yale, Harvard, actually, it's just Yale and Harvard right now, should be immediately struck from consideration for any significant clerkships.
Well, you know, it speaks to a broader societal rot. It's not just the law schools, but everywhere where all this progressive rot pervades. And in just this example, you have, and it's like anything, it goes back to originalism and strict constructionism versus this so-called living and breathing constitution, which it's not a living and breathing constitution. It's people. It's that in societies that are living and breathing that quote-unquote evolve over time. But the thing is, it's the principles of, and what we know is that the constitution does not evolve. The constitution is there to address something that never changes, or if it does change, will change over millions and millions of years, and that's called human nature. People will always be the same and want the same things and be corrupted by the same things. And so that's what that constitution is theoretically, or it was intended to protect us from, was to protect us from being and offer us certain guidelines from going beyond the pale and infringing upon the God-given and inalienable rights that we are granted with life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, free speech, freedom of religion, and so on and so forth. But when you have people that go on that court who basically, you know, are there to just to be a rubber stamp to any whim and then call it, it's a penumbra and an emanation when it comes to, you know, abortion or if it's gun rights or you name it, then, you know, all bets are off.
This is so, the evolution of law should be kept to the states. They are the, you know, they are the laboratories, and they work under the structure of the Constitution, but they are not governed perfectly by that Constitution, and that's why federalism is such a wonderful plan. Unfortunately, the left is uncomfortable with the idea of federalism, and they want one overarching law for the entire country, which means that rural Oklahoma should be governed in the same way as the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and that's simply not tenable in the United States. We are far too liberty-loving a people, or at least we used to be, to tolerate that kind of top-down control. But, you know, when 90% of the justices are from Yale and Harvard, we don't have much choice.
Well, there's the irony, is that the left is now the champions of this diversity, inclusion, and equity. But the problem is they don't want the only diversity they want is the diversity of themselves or their little intersectional categories that they have. When it comes to people from Oklahoma or people from Alaska or people even who may live on the Upper West Side of Manhattan who think that shoving someone in front of a subway train or rubbing feces in their face is not such a great idea. Oh no, they don't want to hear that. Anyway, we're going to take a little bit of a break. This is Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast, and we will be back in just a second. Hang tight. And we're back with the Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks podcast. JJ Sefton here with CBD and Joe Mannix. I think the subject we want to talk about is, look what's going on here with the Chinese coronavirus, or as I like to call it, the General Tso's sickness, which I can't claim credit for that moniker, but it is a good one. Anyway, out of nowhere, the CDC quietly is doing something with the numbers.
Well, they claim that the data on deaths were adjusted, I'm quoting by the way, data on deaths were adjusted after resolving a coding logic error. This resulted in decreased death counts across all demographic categories. That's very interesting. You know, the data that the CDC produces is extraordinarily important for many, many things. And for them to play fast and loose with the numbers is an indictment not only of their political cant, obviously this is not just a coding error, but it also shows their disrespect for the science, because the science is based on the numbers. And what they have done is manipulated the connection between science and public policy to such an extent, and this is just the latest example of it, that they are, I'm not sure that the CDC should be shut down. Actually, that's not true. I think the CDC should be shut down. What do they do for us that any halfway decent university couldn't do for us in terms of number crunching and, you know, the various high-level research projects that they do?
On that, I'm coming around to the idea that perhaps epidemiology actually shouldn't exist. I've never seen a group of people outside of climate scientists get things more wrong more frequently. And it's just data. And we have wonderful statisticians in this world. Most of them work for insurance companies. And if it comes to needing this kind of public service data work, partnering with the insurance companies and asking to borrow their actuaries would probably give us a much better outcome than having a bunch of cloistered epidemiologists working with bad data and doing nothing to improve it. And to what you were talking about there, CBD, on, yes, they say it was a coding error. Things that should not have been considered a COVID death were considered a COVID death due to a technical problem. I have my suspicions that that's probably not true, but let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say that it is. This is still a pretty serious problem, in my opinion, because you have, if you're the CDC, have positioned yourself as the source of truth, the source of good data, the gold standard yardstick against which everything is measured, and you also are responsible for providing that data to policymakers as well as a recommendation on the interpretation of that data. So in effect, the CDC, in a large respect, is driving policy. And the trust that they are competent to do that and capable to do that is gone. It's a zero. They keep lying, and when they're caught in lies, they sometimes acknowledge it and sometimes don't. And even when they're not lying, they're screwing it up. So I'm in agreement with CBD on this one. The CDC, and actually any number of federal agencies, but certainly the CDC, should just be closed. If the job that they are supposed to be doing is valuable, we can create some new agency with new leadership and new practices. But that organization needs to be closed. It needs to just turf it.
I'll put the nail in the coffin on this, or the cherry on top, if you will. This is from this morning's American Thinker, from David Gertler. FDA, CDC guilty of clinical malpractice and scientific fraud by inaction and omission on the mRNA vaccine safety warnings. So here they're revising the statistics downward on who has the COVID thing, and now here they're even just hiding from us all the adverse reactions from these wonderful vaccines that everyone is claiming we need more of, and more boosters, and a booster every 3 seconds. Yeah. So this is just, you're right, this is terrible.
Yeah, and the FDA is at least as bad. And there's, I forget the gentleman's name. I saw a few interviews with him a few weeks ago. He's a Wall Street guy who is basically after it to punish Pfizer and Moderna for their role in hiding a lot of the vaccine data, or flat out lying about a lot of the vaccine data, under the thesis that if we can prove the fraud, fraud voids all contracts. Now they're exposed to liability and we can drive them into the ground. It might not be through jail sentences and punishment, administrative punishments, but we can at least open them to liability. And that's his goal. And I think that it's a pie in the sky notion. These people will be protected. Whether he's technically correct or not is sort of beside the point. I don't think it happens. But the amount of fraud and corruption that has been exposed in especially the vaccine stuff, as well as just the pure data side that the CDC was doing. The CDC technically isn't involved in the vaccine stuff, as far as I know. That's the FDA. But they're all rotten to the core. Even when they're not lying, they're inept. And these are not the people you want basically given dictatorial command power over an entire society. And that's what we've done over the last couple of years. And it couldn't have been put in the hands of a worse group.
Well, we have the FDA and the CDC, who are either mendacious or incompetent. And as Joe pointed out, probably both. But the one of the significant purposes of these organizations is to take the data produced by private organizations like Pfizer and look at that data dispassionately without any financial connection to the product, and then judge it based only on the science. Well, we know that the revolving door between CDC, FDA, and Big Pharma has destroyed that concept of government oversight. And I think the idea that we are now looking to Pfizer for scientific interpretations rather than just products that we can judge is disgusting. Unfortunately, that is the case. We defer to the, quote, scientists, unquote, at Pfizer to decide whether children should get the vaccine, whether we should have a 17th booster. And, you know, the left talks about, you know, trust the science. We're not trusting the science. We're trusting businessmen. And, you know something? They're out for a buck. Do I find that reprehensible? No. That's their jobs. But our job, well, the CDC and the FDA's job is to make sure that they're not getting that buck on the backs of America. And unfortunately, they're not doing their job.
Well, that's just it. It's making a buck is not the problem. It's how you make the buck. It's like, you know, it's the ultimate case, I think, of, what is it, Munchausen's by proxy. You create a virus and then you say, look, I'm here to help you and I have the cure for it. I mean, that's kind of, maybe that's a little bit of a tinfoil hat territory, but I have this article from the National Pulse. Fauci's COVID origins allies, the EcoHealth Alliance, boosted investment income by 350% since the pre-pandemic. Financial disclosures from EcoHealth Alliance reveal that the controversial nonprofit collaborating with the Wuhan Institute of Virology experienced a nearly 350% surge in investment income following the start of the pandemic. Run by notorious COVID-19 origins propagandist and Chinese Communist Party-funded researcher Peter Daszak, the alliance received funding worth millions of dollars from Fauci's National Institute of Health Agency to work on, quote, killer viruses with the Wuhan lab. So they work on the virus, and then on the other hand, they're in bed with Moderna and Merck and Pfizer and Johnson to develop the, quote, unquote, cure, the magic bullet, which you have to take now every year. You know, this is just, this is not capitalism. This is something else entirely, my friends.
Yeah, I think it's opportunistic. I'm not willing to put that tinfoil hat on, or at least pull it down tight. But, you know, opportunism in government is something that we need to avoid. And it's so obvious that this is happening. And you know, you look at Fauci's financial records, which unfortunately we can't see enough of, even though he's an employee of the United States government. That should be 100% available to anybody who wants to look at it. But again, it comes back to this unholy alliance between government and private industry. Correct private industry. And, the approved private
industry. Yeah, and enough size and overlapping mission and mandate within the government to make sure that bad behavior can continue apace. What I really find fascinating about the EcoHealth and Daszak angle is before they got their funding from the NIH, they went and sought that funding from DARPA. And what they were trying to do, at least on paper, is we want to create a vaccine for SARS and SARS-like viruses. And they took their plans to DARPA to get funding. And the guys at DARPA said, hell no, this is incredibly reckless. This is very dangerous. This is probably illegal. You don't have anything like enough control mechanism in place. No, we're not giving you a dime. And so they just packed up that slide deck and took it over to the NIH and got it there. And I think that this is, I don't think it was the purpose necessarily, but it certainly is a consequence of all of these overlapping agencies that we have. You know, you have overlap between USDA and FDA. You have overlap between FDA and NIH, and between NIH and CDC, and between all of them in the Department of Defense. And I think a consequence of all of this, of basically inefficient, opportunistic government, is if you get told no by mom, you can go ask dad.
Isn't Fauci's wife like some sort of head of something at the NIH?
Yeah, head of ethics.
Some sort of, at one of these.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah, she's the ethics head.
Yes, and and David Duke is going to be appointed the head of Hadassah at any moment, right? Talk about bar mitzvahs. This is just, I was going to say that, you know, all of this leads to the one big F word, fascism, you know, and, you know, you can't spell fascism without Fauci, but it's crazy. This is just absolute, you know, we're talking about Yale Law School and originalism in the Constitution, and you got to scratch your head and go, you know, I know it's only been about 240 years or so, but this is not where we're supposed to be, folks. This is through the glass and very darkly.
No, and this is the, you know, this is the drum I've been beating for years and years and years, and that is that the framers of the Constitution, the framers of our of our government understood that government is evil. And one of their many laudable goals was to limit the size of government. Well, you know something? A small government can do a lot of damage, but the Leviathan that we have now is doing incalculable damage. And the conservative cant has always been shrink government, shrink government, shrink government. Well, it has never happened. But we see the results of growing it, and those results are not very impressive. We have an unending list of failures going back to the New Deal, actually even before that. League of Nations, you know, Wilson was no charmer. And as government grows, government gets more and more power to do evil. I would prefer little evil, little government, but
I think someone once said the primary mission of any bureaucracy is to further the bureaucracy. It is not to solve the problem. And so hence, you know, that's why we have to shift gears. That's why you have things like the so-called, Middle East peace process. Well, if there's Middle East peace, well, you don't need the bureaucracy anymore. So the process is this, you know, it's this never-ending, I don't know, self-licking ice cream cone, if I can not be obscene about the whole thing. But I mean, it's crazy. And it goes on, and it's at our expense, and it grows and grows and grows. And the more it grows, the more it sucks our freedom and our livelihoods and so on and so forth until it just has to collapse in on itself. There is no, I mean, well, that's where we're headed right now. 5.8 trillion, I think, was the latest, and Joe Biden is claiming he's shrunk the deficit. Oh boy, crazy. Hey, let's take a break. We'll be back in 2 seconds. Cut Chip Newsletter Speaks, the podcast. Hang in there, folks. And we're back. This is Cut Kid Newsletter Speaks, the podcast, CBD. J.J. Sefton here with Joe Mannix. And, CBD, you mentioned a very interesting little tidbit about the American taxpayer.
Yes, interesting and rather vomit-inducing. According to the data that I saw, 57% of U.S. households paid no income tax last year. That might be in part because of the COVID insanity and the bonus checks that everybody was getting and so on and so forth. But, and again, I didn't dip down into the data very much, but that's a pretty damning number. And even if it were only 49% or 47%, it doesn't matter. The fact is that Americans should have some stake in their country. And the easiest way to force that is to create a tax regime that is top to bottom. And you know something? I don't care if the 12-year-old who gets his first job cleaning out the ice cream bins at a local store, he should pay tax. How much tax? How about 1%? How about 2%? Something that he would notice on his paycheck. And no matter what, people should have some stake in the game. And yet, as we have progressed further and further into what is essentially socialism, more and more people are on the government teat, and fewer people are paying those bills.
I was going to say the person cleaning up the ice cream freezer, I guess it wouldn't be Nancy Pelosi's kitchen. I don't know if that person would be subject to a tax.
I'm sure that person's an illegal.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the milk gotten out of that government teat is going less far than ever. And it's because of the increase in scope. And I suspect that the 57% figure is probably because of all the Trump bucks and Biden bucks that went out the door. But as it stands, it's still year after year, fewer and fewer people are actually, percentage-wise, are actually paying a positive tax burden. And now we see what comes of that. You have government finances completely out of control. We have large inflation. We have crushing debt. And this is we're harvesting the fruits of our UBI crop that we've been planting over the last couple of years. And to what you were saying, CBD, if you buy anything or if you work, you should have some sort of positive tax burden. I agree. I actually would rather see a sales tax rather than an income tax. There's a, you know, who knows, there's a bunch of ways to go about squaring that circle. But another thing that I would like to see, and this will never happen, and I understand this is a fairly unpopular position, but one thing that I would like to see is tie it to the franchise. If you are not a net taxpayer, you don't vote. Because if you are, if you're not a net taxpayer and you're voting, you're voting for a living. Right. And I have a serious problem with that. And I think that that would also help the problem. It's probably not consistent with anything approaching what's in our Constitution. But just as a thought exercise, if nothing else, there's a lot of ways to solve the problem. But it's a problem nobody wants to solve, because if you're in that 57% that is now dependent on the government, then you're easily controlled. They want you to have windmill power, well, they can dictate those terms to you. They want you to eat synthetic meat, they can dictate those terms to you.
I think that your suggestion is a fine one, and you probably should hang out at Ace of Spades more, because you're going to find a lot of people who love the idea of having some skin in the game before you vote.
Well, that's just the whole thing. I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, Rick Scott presented this, you know, whatever it was, this program of conservatism, and which got, of course, he got challenging Mitch McConnell, I suppose, in a way. And one of his things was literally to say poor people should pay taxes, or at least that was how the language is mangled by the media. But in a way, he's right. Look, you know, whether you want to call it a fair tax, a flat tax, or however you want to do it, everybody, if you just did this, if you did away with income tax completely, not complete, but you did away with the code the way it is. And everybody, no matter who you are, you pay X percent of your income, period, end of story. No deductions, no ups, no extras, no nothing like that. You know, everybody would have skin in the game, and you'd see a lot more people concerned about how the government uses their money or abuses their money. And in essence, it also limits the amount of money in a way that the government can at least take in, theoretically, I should say, if you codify it. And at that point, it would also limit the size of government.
But the thing is that the reality is that with a flat tax like that, the amount of money that the government will take in would probably dip at first. But with that kind of a tax scheme, my guess is that supply side economics would kick in with a vengeance, and we would see growth. We would see efficiencies that would dwarf anything we've seen in the last.
That's true. But
years.
What you can do. But the thing is, what you could do, and this is all just sort of me being, you know, a failing economics student, you could use that money. You have how many trillion dollars in debt do we have? You could use that money to pay down the debt, theoretically, and then to a certain point when it's at zero, when we have a balanced budget, then we can sort of rejigger how taxes are collected and where it goes and so on and so forth, where you actually have a trust that's put in there for a rainy day or whatever. But, yeah, the odds of that happening are, of course, slim and none.
Well, Biden's new suggestion for a billionaire's tax? I read it, and I honestly thought I'd read it incorrectly, because he wants to slap a 10 or 20% tax on realized capital gains, and as far as I can tell, unrealized capital gain. Now, if you think about that, it's ridiculous, even for Washington standards. Taxing unrealized gains is a hugely dangerous thing to do, because it would tamp down any idea of risk. So money would no longer flow to easy, not so easy, and very, very risky financial propositions. It would flow to the easiest and most stable. And that would destroy innovation, essentially, in the United States. But that's okay.
It's fairness.
Yeah, it's fair.
and it's incredibly fair to tax something that doesn't exist. Like the unrealized capital gains tax concept is so astonishing to me, because it literally doesn't exist. That's what unrealized means. It is not made real yet. But you have to pay it with real money.
You know, it's funny. I always thought that, you know, they talk about people paying their fair share and this and that and the 1% and the 99% and all this garbage. And I'm going, look, let's just do a little thought experiment. We rip the government for printing money and borrowing and borrowing. I'm saying, well, if you're going to print and borrow with no limits, with what is this, modern monetary theory, which is insane, then why tax anybody anything? Just print all the money that you need and buy whatever the hell you want and leave us alone. Of course, it can't be done.
Well, but it's a rational analysis of the situation. It makes perfect sense. If you accept modern economic theory, government spending theory, Of course, it's
yeah, total horseshit. Belief, but I mean, but, you know, but it's just. I mean, I just use it as a thought exercise to sort of to try to trap liberals and hoist them on their own petard, so to speak. But it's just, you know, you can't reason with that. It's just, you know, nuts. Look, I have no qualms about billionaires making money. Let them make money. It's great, wonderful. Make your money. But to sort of put the burden on them to pay more. I mean, why should they pay more? And somebody who makes, you know, $10,000 a year not pay any more. That's not fair. I mean, if either there's fairness and equity and skin in the game, or there isn't. And if some are more fair than others, with, you know, a nod to Animal Farm, then it's, you know, it's just a hypocrisy.
Well, this is class warfare, clearly. It worked for the communists for a long, long time. In the United States, we've moved on to racial divisions. And because that isn't working quite as well as they want, they have to return to class warfare. And it makes perfect sense. This is the socialist playbook. And they've read it. They've all read it quite well. And they know how to run it. Just a little pop from the headlines. Bill Gates wants developed countries to eat only synthetic meat, laboratory-produced meat, and to reserve genetically modified natural meat for developing countries. Now, I don't understand the logic behind it, but I certainly don't like the idea that a multi-billionaire is going to dictate policy for the world. But of course, this is globalism. This is exactly the kind of stuff that we would get on a smaller scale. This is why the United Kingdom rejected Brexit, because they don't want to be told what to do.
You know, maybe farms. We should have that 20% tax on multi-billionaires. Hit Bill Gates with it. Make it 100% just for that idiotic statement alone. I mean, but at least it's a step up from bugs. I think somebody just wanted us to eat insects and not meat at all. So I guess it's something. This is just, these people are just...
Yeah. Oh, don't worry, JJ. That's where we'll get, because the synthetic meat thing depends on technology that doesn't exist yet. So while that's coming, you can eat the bugs.
Okay.
And we promise it'll be here, and it's right around the
Soylent,
corner.
Soylent something. It's people, yes.
So I write a food thread for Ace of Spades once a week, and I have been telling myself that I should bite the bullet and go to the supermarket and pick up 3 or 4 different kinds of this near meat or fake meat or synthetic meat or whatever they call it, and do a real taste test. but I'm a coward. I don't want to do that.
I think
that.
One time I...
It doesn't sound very pleasant at all.
I think a long time ago I bought one of these. I think I was living in California. Where else? And I actually sucked it up and I bought a pack of these things. They were called Boca Burgers. God, they were horrendous. They were just literally like eating... I don't know what the hell. It was... tough, chewy, yeah, you know, there was no flavor to it, and, you know, everybody's, oh, it's great, you know, veggie burger, they're wonderful, they're just like meat. No, they're not.
Joe,
sorry.
In your neck of the woods, are they pushing this in the supermarkets, or are you, do you
it's
live a, in a sane?
It's available. No, it's available in the supermarket, and, you know, they have ads for it in the circulars sometimes. As far as, in my experience, it hasn't been like a, you should get this or you're a bad person. Like, that's not the marketing tack they're taking. It's just, it's in the cabinet.
It will be.
And it's in the,
it will be
the refrigeration,
it will be the,
cases. Yeah.
It will be the marketing tactic. It will be the marketing tactic.
Yeah. One of the things that really stood out to me at the beginning of the COVID madness, when there were those first shortages, when all the supermarkets emptied because everyone was panicked, was you had meat and dairy departments that were just picked over, nothing left. And the vegan fake meat stuffed to the brim. Nobody wants it.
Well, this has been the Cut Chip Newsletter Speaks podcast, episode 16. JJ Sefton here with CBD and Joe Mannix. Thanks, guys, for stopping by, and we'll see you next week in the Funny Papers.
Thanks for listening, folks.
Thanks, as always.